Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention?
From the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for him.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I give it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that?
No, Sensei.
No mercy.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight in the middle of your Black Panther party.
Jake LaTondres.
I am bad news. I'm going to break you.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet you slice into the woods $100.
Gambling is illegal at Bushwood, sir, and I never slice.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, been saved.
Well, that's it, boys. I've been redeemed. The preacher done washed away all my sins and transgressions.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur, and on the other end of the line of the Duck South Studios, all of the pits, Steven, Patrick, Mr. Pat. Guys, how are y'all?
Good evening. Fine.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Doing pretty good.
Dang, y'all have got that down. I don't even have to get on to y'all anymore. I mean, it's just like a step process.
Well, age before beauty.
And I started younger and worked my way up.
Yeah. Well, I'm not as shy as the other two are.
I want to know something. How big are UT fans, are y'all?
If you cut it down, bleed orange. You know, I introduced the boys to UT football when they were still teething, I imagine. But, you know, I was born and raised in Chattanooga area, East Tennessee, and some of my fondest memories with my dad was going to Tennessee football games because he wasn't a hunter. He was a golfer, but like I've said in the past, but we used to live running up and down the highway to Knoxville.
All right, so as I'm investigating for pictures each week, you know, I go diving through old Facebook pictures to utilize for the covers of these episodes. And, you know, that's something that's very, well, it's across the board between all three of y'all. You see that the Tennessee orange on all three of y'all's pages.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Patrick's Chesapeake was named, help me, son.
They was big orange Rocky Top.
Yeah, big orange Rocky Top. That was his, they called him Rocky, of course. But
and, you know, we always, everybody wants to ask us, how do y'all live in Mississippi and pull for Tennessee? It's just like Dad said, you know, that's what he grew up sharing with his dad. So it's passed down through the family for us. It's not just, you know, we haven't always been to Mississippi either anyway. So, but you know, that's how Steven and I have become, you know, diehard Tennessee fans that, you know, it started with our granddad and maybe even before him. You know, I don't know if his dad was a Tennessee fan. I don't know how he started, you know, his like of the team, but that's how it got to us anyway.
All right, let's play a little game before we jump into stories. We are building a Mount Rushmore for Tennessee football. Whose faces, let's see, Mount Rushmore contains five faces?
Four.
Yeah, I don't know why I said five. Oh, because my kids, when we were out there the last time, were standing in the freaking middle of the crowd, and my kids look up, I don't know if it was my middle or my youngest, they looked up at me and said, "We see Mount Rushmore, but where's Trump's face?" You want to talk about a bunch of liberals turning around and giving us the eye.
Oh, that's funny.
We've got a picture. We've got a picture of Patrick standing with Mount Rushmore in the background, holding a Merriam's turkey.
The turkey.
Yeah.
I talked to Patrick before when I say about Mount Rushmore. No. I've taken a picture with mine at the gate to Disney World.
That's right.
And Patrick he put this one up of Mount Rushmore, and I said, "We're pretty equal there."
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
So, anyway, you know, I told the kids going out there, hey, it's the president's faces up on the mountain, our best presidents ever. So, we're walking in there. We're, you know, it's 300 people standing around. One of my, I don't know if it's like I said, Taylor or Wilson. Where's Trump's face then? Oh, boy. All right. So, back to the original thought. If we're building a Mount Rushmore in the Smoky Mountains of East Tennessee to Tennessee football players, the greatest football players at Tennessee, whose faces are we putting up there? Coaches, too. Include coaches.
That's easy.
Oh, yeah.
There's Johnny Majors, Peyton Manning, Condridge Holloway, and then it's a toss-up. I'd probably say Willie Gault, maybe, or gosh, there's so many wideouts we've had, but the boys may have four others. I don't know. I know who I'd want up there. Reggie White. That'd be my fourth one.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
Because I can tell you about Reggie. When I played baseball back in Chattanooga, we had a summer league that we played in, and Reggie White's daddy was the pitcher on one of the pitchers on our team, Charlie, and Reggie was our bat boy.
Really?
Yeah, a little snot-nosed kid running around, you know, shagging balls and picking up bats and whatnot. And actually, a good friend of mine was his homeroom teacher at Kirkman High School before he went to Knoxville. Yeah, I'd be remiss by not putting Reggie White up there with the other three.
All right, boys. Any of those that you grew up with that you think deserve to be up there? There's no denying Peyton Manning and Johnny Majors. No denying. Their face is automatically at the Carver.
Yeah, I mean, Johnny Major was, I'm too young to remember him, of course. Of course, Peyton Manning, it's, you know, if any Tennessee fan doesn't put him up there, something's wrong with him.
yeah.
You know, who I got to see him and watch and play, you know, over my years, definitely Peyton Manning's up there. Al Wilson, definitely one. Of course, to me, Phil Fulmer, the other, gosh, if I had to put a fourth one up out of that bunch, it would be, oh, man.
T. Martin.
Yeah, T.
Martin.
Martin. He did some stuff that Peyton Manning never got to do, but, you know, if it wasn't for Peyton, T. Martin couldn't do what he did. But, gosh, it'd be a
nerd. Sorry, I shouted that out because I was trying to think of that name.
Leonard Little had a pretty good NFL career for a while too. One of our All American linebackers.
Big Orange Day
when Leonard Little he had to sit out a year or go to a junior college or something. When he came back, he was one of the first players that I went up and shook his hand and told him welcome back. And he put his other meat hook hand on top of mine. He said, I really appreciate that. And I remember that to this day.
Yeah. My funny one was I got married in September. And, my wife picked the month of September to get married in. And she goes, what weekend? And how I decided what weekend was to look at the Tennessee football schedule and to see who we were playing. And just went from there for like, all right, it's not a big deal. I can look at this weekend. All right, that's not a big game. All right, we'll get married that weekend. And it kind of based my marriage off of who Tennessee was playing that weekend. So
well, you got to get your priorities straight.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, it.
I went the other way with that. I got married on the third weekend in October, which to a Tennessee fan that means the weekend we play Alabama. But,
yeah, that's right.
We have struggled with Alabama as of late, as with most anybody. but I knew that we weren't going to miss much of the football game with wedding festivities, so I wasn't too upset to not watch that one on TV.
Yeah, it's a sad world where the most consistent team that's beating Alabama is named Ole Miss.
Yeah, that hurts.
One thing
you can say about Peyton Manning, though, he never beat Florida, but he didn't lose to Alabama.
That's true.
That is true.
So
talking about weddings, one of the specific things I laid out, no turkey season, no football season, no duck season. And so I got married February the 25th.
That's not bad.
Well, I got married April 8th, but I've turkey hunted on our anniversary numerous times, and Gail never lets me forget.
Well, when y'all got married, you weren't a turkey hunter. You didn't start turkey hunting until Steven and I got into it late in our high school, early college career.
Yeah, y'all said, we want to go turkey hunting. I said, okay, that's fine. I've killed turkeys before. I just ain't kill some more, so... That's what started all that off. But it's been a good run either way.
Well, guys, for the past 2 weeks, we have covered two really, really interesting topics in talking about the bands, talking about the dogs 2 weeks ago. I know that there is something that after we got done recording, y'all probably went, oh man, how do we leave that out? Is there anything that we missed in those two topics that we need to cover before we move on?
Nah, I mean, there's. I know that between the three of us could come up with a pile of stories, but I've had a story on my list that I made when you and I first started talking about this podcast that I wanted Dad to tell, and it's about one of his dogs. It's about his first Chesapeake, Jake. And a hunt on the Mississippi River there outside of Memphis.
Yeah, we were hunting on Cat Island, which is south of Memphis, and in a switchwheeler flat on the tip on the lower end of the island, and birds, you know, they really like that area down in there, but you know where we had to park a boat was. Gosh, dang near a quarter mile from that switchwheeler flat because there wasn't any place else to put it that we, you know, would have to worry about current or a barge swamping it or whatnot. So we had to get around on the backside of the island to hide the boat, and then there was a rock dike between there and where we were hunting. So we just walked down and carried a dozen decoys and, you know, stood in the edge of the water there. That was back before there were rough stands and whatnot to put your dog on, but Jake was, you know, he'd stand there, you know, with water up to his chest almost, and we'd shoot ducks and he'd go get them because that's what retrievers do. But we had some ducks come in. There was four of us shooting. We had a flock of ducks come in and killed three or four right in a hole in the decoys, and one going out shot him down and it fell dead out there. But one of the ducks in front of us was flopping across water. And of course, Jake would run over a dead bird to get a cripple, you know, so he gathered those three up. And when he got them back, I was thinking, well, we'll just have to go get the boat and get this other one because it's in the current. Well, he squared around. I took the duck from him, and he's locked where that other bird fell. So being stupid at that time, I went ahead and sent him. You know, he broke through the willows, got in the current, and he's headed downriver toward that duck. I could barely see it, you know, floating almost around a little bend there. And he's gone, and he's gone, and he's gone. And, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, Lord of mercy, I've done sent my dog somewhere where I shouldn't have. And, you know, barge traffic up and down the river, and, you know, I didn't know what he was dealing with. So I waded out of the water and walked all the way back up to where the boat was, and I was going to have to come around, come through a cut to get down there to him. And about the time I got to the boat and pushed off and got out into the water, way down the riverbank on the Arkansas side, I could see Jake coming back with that duck. How far he went to get it in that current, I have no idea. But, you know, I'm talking 30, 45 minutes from when I sent him. I finally saw him again coming back. So, you know, he comes back and swims across the cut behind the island, and, you know, he's sitting there waiting on me when I finally get back there out of breath. So, perseverance, and, you know, he knew the job at hand, and I can never say enough about a dog that gives, you know, a 90-pound dog or a 100-pound dog, it's got 100 pounds of heart. So, you know, I wouldn't take nothing for a lot of memories like that with these dogs. That's why I revere them so much.
Well, there's one thing that I've learned is if you ever run into anybody that hunted or worked on the Mississippi River, if you are patient enough to sit there and talk to them and listen to them, sit there and listen and talk to them, man, you'll hear some of the most interesting stories to come off that Mississippi River. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. And Gail, when the boys were old enough to start hunting, you know, about the only thing that I've done that she told me to do when it comes to duck hunting is she didn't want me to carry the boys out on the river. So when they were young, so I didn't.
There was a guy that used to come to my wife for a veterinarian while we were in Greenville, Mississippi, and he was a tugboat driver. And I don't mean to interrupt into y'all's stories, but anyway, I was sitting there talking to him one afternoon when I was there at the same time as he was. He was talking about these tugboats going up and down. He said that the river, it will spit logs up out of it, logs that are way bigger than telephone poles, and just spin them up like a toothpick.
Yeah, I've seen them stand them up. I've seen those whirlpools out there around some of the rock dikes. It'd spin a log around it and stand straight up like a totem pole. You know, it's no place to be stupid.
No. He was telling me that they had a couple of boats where the river shot a log out of the water, and it went through the pilot's cabin of the tugboat.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, didn't mean to interrupt that.
But one of the one story that we talked about this afternoon between the three of us after we all messaged in our message is a story that I won't. It's a quick little story, but I want Steven to tell it. It's a combination. It's a band and a dog story.
it would go hand in hand, dog and band. And, pretty sure it was Thanksgiving morning. Gosh, this is probably, I'm guessing about 2009 maybe. And hunting one of our good pits and clear sky that morning. Walking the pit, of course, way before shooting time, but it was so like a full moon bright, of course, you could see really well across the field walking out there. Where Josie never was at heel. I mean, I didn't mind it because she'd, I didn't want to trip over in the dark and fall down. So she'd always run in front of me and just, get to the pit way before I did. So the geese had always would early in the season would roost in this field, it seemed like. And, I was walking out of the field, you could see several snow geese out in the field that were dead, from the night before to spend the night in there. Where Josie was, as I walked to the pit, Josie was just constantly bringing me snow geese. And I'm like, the more she brings me, the more I got to carry out of the field is what I'm thinking. And about the fourth one she brings me, I'm glad she brought it to me because it was a double banded snow goose, had a $50 reward band on it. So I was, I got me a band way before shooting time. And I remember sending Patrick Dad a text that morning and said, I'm making money already. And, she picked up, I think that morning before I even got to the fish, she picked up at least a dozen snow geese before, we even fired her shot, just walking the fish. She was just running around like, hunting up, and I'm sure she could see them too and smelling them. But man, she at least brought me a dozen geese that morning, like the third or fourth one was that banded snow goose. And, like I said, she was, picking them up and carrying them as far as, I don't know how far she was coming back with them. I have no idea. I couldn't see her. But, she made me a little money that morning.
Yeah, there was a time when, several times I wanted to change Josie's name to Herpes because she wouldn't heal, but that was a beneficial part of her mantra, I guess. She loved to hunt.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't think it was the same year, but I know it would have been around the same time. It may have been a year or two off. Like I said, I don't think it was the same year, but there was a had a real bad, was it botulism, Dad, that was killing all those geese?
Alpha toxin. Oh, no. Geese?
Yeah.
With cholera.
Or cholera, that's right, avian cholera. And, you know, we had one field that the snow geese were roosting in real hard that, I mean, I bet we picked up 300 dead snow geese out of that field because they end up being a pain in the butt because you're out there duck hunting and, you know, a big white snow goose laying out there on the water, that dog, you know, your dog's going to key on it a lot until they pick it up. So we try to round geese up, you know, daily pretty much. But Dad and I were hunting a pit of ours up in the edge of Craighead County, and across the ditch in the field that had CRP grass in it, the geese had spent the night, and Dad and I, after we duck hunted, carried our dogs over there, we're running blinds on those birds. And of course, you know, like I say, a snow goose out in the middle of either the water or a dry bean field, I mean, it's not a hard line for a dog, but it's good to stretch them out. And then we had probably picked up 20 birds or so, and we're driving out. And of course, Dad and we were taking turns. And the last goose to pick that we ended up picking up was my turn. And it was a snow goose that was laying no more than 20 feet from the paved road that anybody in the world could have stopped and picked up with a dog or something before we could have done anything, even with it being on our lease and us right there. I mean, you know, it was that close, and it was a snow goose with a band on it.
Oh, man.
Well, you know, dogs are good for a lot of things, but I don't know, probably a third of the bands I've gotten I may not have gotten unless I had a dog. I had Clipper find a mallard that I had crippled, dying 45 minutes after I had shot it, and then Ace ran one down in a ditch that I couldn't even see once he got back through the grass behind me. I mean, it's just on and on and on what these dogs have done for us, you know, other than just the joy of hunting with them. Yeah, I mean, as I've said before, it ought to be against law to hunt without one.
You know, back a few weeks ago, we kind of stopped going in a chronological order, and somewhere in there we stopped, I guess, when we were working this thing kind of chronologically. I just thought it'd be better just to let you guys tell stories. But one of the things that we've talked a little bit about was the formation of the Langille Lounge. Can we go into a little bit of detail and tell that story of how the Langille came about?
Well,
oh yeah.
You want to go, Pat? I don't care which one.
Well, I mean,
if you have another story that we need to tell before that, that's just something I wanted to throw out there.
You know, I used to guide down south, down there at near Hunter, and you know, I couldn't take my boys every time I went because of, you know, obligations and this, that, and the other with the guys that owned the place. And so I started looking for a place to call our own. And I can't remember, Patrick, how we ended up there. Was it Dutch that introduced us to Clay and got that?
Yeah, that's how it got started. I don't know how you got hooked up with Dutch, but he's the
taxidermy
one.
He came to me wanting a bunch of ducks mounted. I remember.
Okay,
that.
Yeah, that's what it was. So Dutch is the one that got us up in that area. And I think met Clay Hubbard and Nolan Evans at a DU banquet, I think is how that all started.
Yeah, Clay introduced me to Nolan, and we leased our first pit from him, and he had a a 1950 model concrete block house that may have been where his grandmother used to live, and I'm not sure if that's right, but they, you know, fraternity parties and everything else is what they used it for, but I mean, that went along with the pit we leased, so we'd have a place to spend a night, and we'd have to drive back and forth. And then, you know, we leased another pit and added, you know, a friend as a member, and it kind of snowballed from there. We built a back porch on it, a covered back porch, and we built a picking shed. And 3 years ago, 4 years ago, whatever it was, we added another 900 square feet to basically a great room. I mean, it's got a kitchen in one corner and, you know, recliners and big screen TV and, you know, another bathroom. So, you know, it just kind of, it's like a big Lego. We just kept building on to it and adding pits. And I just went over this past Tuesday and did a handshake deal on two more pits we're going to have this year. And you never know how ones are going to work out, but I've got a little history on one of them. So if they work, fine. And I generally will take a pit. This one pit that I got, it's in beans. You never know how bean fields are going to shoot. But I'm going to have it for at least 2 years because I want it in rice just to see. But I've hunted this field before and have done well in it. So and I try not to put all my eggs in one basket and have all of our pits within sight of each other. I mean, we're basically in three counties now, or four, two, maybe three. I don't know. We're spread out enough to where, you know, we're not hunting the same ducks. So, but that's how it started. That was in 92, I guess.
Yeah, we leased our first pit in 92 and actually split the house with Paul and Doc Brown because they had the Morgan Farm pit and needed a place to stay.
Yeah, and, so that saved us a little money there, and you know, with friends of ours, and then it just kind of, you know, we've never had to advertise for members. It's always been, you know, somebody that a friend of ours that we let in, or a friend of Patrick or Stevens, you know, well, you know, hey, I'd like to join a member, you know, join in. So, you know, we add two members, we get another pit thereabout. So it works out pretty well. I mean, it just, yeah, we may not kill 100 ducks a day like some of these, you know, big clubs, but we do all right, and we're comfortable, and it's something we can call our very own virtually. I mean, everything's done on a handshake over there, and I respect the farmers and their land, and they appreciate us, you know, watching out for their property. So that's the story of the Lion Gale.
Been some legendary pictures taken on that old wall.
No, that's for yeah. Sure. Gary Zahm, I don't know if you ever heard of Gary Zahm or not. He's he's written for every waterfowl magazine there is and had pictures published all over the place, but he was a refuge manager in South Dakota, North Dakota, one of the Dakotas, and then moved to California and managed three others. But he came and hunted with us 1 year. I met him, I don't know if it was through Argentina or how that, maybe if we went to South Dakota together through a mutual friend, I think that's what it was, but he came down there and photographed one day, and that was back before digital, and he shot 36 rolls of 36 exposure film at snow geese in the field in our backyard, basically. He said as many snow geese as he's seen in California and the Dakotas, he said that was the largest flock of snows he had ever witnessed. And, you know, everybody's guess was 250 to 300,000. And it was impressive. I've got some pictures of it, and it just, you know, you can't see blue sky for the snow geese. So, but that, yeah, I mean, there's so many pictures. I know when Ramsey would be up there, he'd shoot as many pictures as he did bullets, if you can believe that. But
the wall. I see that wall in so many pictures, and I sit there and think to myself as I scroll through all these pictures of the different days of hunting that stretch back years in these photo albums. Man, if that wall could talk, if that wall could tell the stories of the stories that got told in front of it.
Oh, yeah. It happened to say.
Didn't somebody ask if we had any idea how many ducks have hung on that since 92?
Oh, I mean, I'm sure. And, you know, you keep pretty meticulous records of what we kill out of the club. And, I mean, you know, not, of course, not every duck we kill touches that wall. But, I mean, you can pretty much you can come up with a rough guess of what's hung on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's I guess it's I don't know, our logo, so to speak, for all rights and purposes. But it's just a nice place. You know, everybody wants grip and grin pictures.
I've told all y'all this before. I think it's nice how you do it. You respect the animal that you kill. It's not done in the cool pile pick way of today. I'll say this: you guys keep them separated. You know whose birds are whose when they're up on that wall. It's not just let's throw all these mallards up here and then we'll get them back down after it's over with. They're separated
on the front of a boat or something like that. The way we do it, everybody comes in with their straps. We've got what we call the Waterfowler Special or the Langille Lounge duck strap. Just about everybody's got one, and we tag our limits on the straps, and they generally hang on the back porch till somebody gets motivated to start putting them on the wall. When they do that, they'll take the tag off, and they'll put it on the wall, and then they'll put six ducks. They'll take a tag off another one. So the tags are hanging under the bird. Should it ever come up, and we've had game wardens, we've consulted with them, should it ever come up, you know, that whose duck is this and whose duck is that, we just move the duck out of the way, pull the tag out, and say, here's my tag. I got four mallards, a pintail, and a gadwall, or whatever. And, you know, it's pretty much foolproof.
Now, I think it is. It is definitely legal, and some of the stuff that I see online today, I'll tell you what gets me is some of these guide services that post some of these pictures of these ducks and geese just piled on top of one another. There's no way and they may be. They may have their legs tied off into a, you know, with a zip tie or something. You know whose limit is whose. But if you're listening to this, I can tell you now the federal game warden is watching you on social media, and you better have a distinct separation of whose ducks or geese in your pictures.
Yeah, we used to have a log book that we would log in. Each person would come in and sign it and put down what ducks he killed. And we asked one of the game wardens, he said, that won't really fly. So, you know,
the crazy thing about the log book is one of the county game wardens had suggested that to us. And when he took a promotion and moved county, the new guy is the one that said, no, the logbook's not good. We need tags. And that's when we started, you know, tagging our straps and leaving the tags with them on the wall and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, we go to Staples and get a box of 1,000 tags. And, you know, everybody comes in, unless you got an emergency 911 gorilla doo-doo you got to drop. Everybody comes in, and before they do anything else, they tag their straps. And the ones that have been lackadaisical and sitting in there on the couch or, you know, trying to eat the bacon as it's coming off the griddle, you know, I have a little conversation with them, about three words, and they get the picture. But you don't want a target on your back. If you're a duck camp, a duck club, somebody in a truck or that's recognizable, you don't want a target on your back. If they ever come down on you for something, like they did another club in our area, you know, you're going to get tired of seeing them. So that's the reason we play by the rules and cross the T's and dot the I's. It's their rules, and we got to abide by them. So it's not hard.
I hate to ask y'all a technical question, but being that the Langille, and we're talking about the Langille, is a lot of fields. It's mostly all fields, correct?
It is, yeah.
Right, yeah, it's all fields.
How do you guys, and I hate to break away from the stories to talk about something technical. How do you guys handle snow geese when they really start to pile up? Because, I mean, they will eat up a place in no time.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, one of y'all.
Well, I mean, you know, if they're in one of our fields, we'll get them out. I mean, you know, because the ducks don't really like to associate with them. You know, snow goose is about like a hog out there in those fields. They're grunting and rooting and digging and carrying, you know, because like Canada geese and white fronts, they're not as bad. They tend to graze, where snow geese tend to grub, and they dig, and they're messy, and they're loud, and
their levees down too.
You know, you'll shoot ducks in a white spread, and you'll see them, you know, off to the side when they're, you know, when usually in the field, but they don't like to get in there with them. And we'll try to keep the snow geese run out of us. But like Steven mentioned, especially early in the season, especially the week of Thanksgiving and on early December, they're around our club. We have a lot of snow geese, and that's where, you know, that's just where they hit early in the year. And then it seems after Christmas and later on, they shift a little more west, and we lose them, and then they'll have to worry about them as bad.
Yeah, our peak migration seems like it hits us is like the week before Thanksgiving all the way to like the second week of December is our, you know, most snow geese we'll have all year long, it seems like.
And we persuade them every now and then to go somewhere else, too.
I'm wondering.
I mean, we killed probably right at 100 out of the backyard this year, literally. And I don't know how many birds that we've dropped that have come close to hitting trucks or bounced off the roof or whatever. I mean, we generally got guns loaded in the gun rack because they'll come back in behind us where they're roosting and killed several banded birds standing there in the yard. So, you know, they live a hard life if they get close to us.
I can tell you this, that man, you can go in behind them on a field just like with what y'all have, and it just smells like a sewage. If they've been there, wow.
They're nasty birds.
Somebody did a study, and he probably got $1 million grant to do it from some university, but somebody did a study, and they said a snow goose defecates every 8 minutes. So you put 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 or 10,000 snow geese out in a rice field, I mean, they're a doo-doo factory out there. I mean, and that's, you know, nothing smells worse than you know, wheat or some kind of vegetable material that's been passed through and tested.
Oh, spring snow geese hitting those green winter wheat fields. Oh, my gosh. That's the worst there is.
Absolutely. Yeah, they'll turn it into a mud hole out there, and the farmers hate them. And,
well, I mean, the smell's just awful. That green.
Oh, yeah, it is that, yeah.
They stink. You know, they get a bad rap about, you know, a lot of people don't think they taste good. And Dad and Steven and I have eaten them, you know, our whole hunting careers. It's all about how you cook them. You know, they're not a white front or they're not a green wing tail or whatever, but, you know, they still eat good despite what most people think.
Well, they're great birds for gumbo or even, you know, duck poppers because they're not all greasy, but I just soon eat one of them. Canada, to me, is like eating an elephant ear.
I mean, we've had a lot of snuggies turn into sausage, you know, summer sausage, you know, the jalapeno cheese sausage. I mean, people think it's deer meat without, you know, people just won't believe it's snuggies. It's pretty good. So it's, like Patrick said, it's just all in how you prepare it.
Yeah, I'll make sure we save you a stick for when you come up. It's good. Real good.
It amazes me how some of these rumors get started about these different species. And I know it's all about where they sit, where they feed. But snow geese and shovelers, I don't get the bad rap because they taste just fine to me. Just like you said, in a popper, they taste really good.
Well, yeah. I can imagine that the spoons that maybe spend their life, or at least their winter, on a sewage lagoon or even a catfish pond probably have a wang to them. But over there around us, when it's all relatively clean rice water, I mean, you can cook a spoon and a mallard and nobody can tell the difference.
Nope. You know, the only bad rap that I have on shovelers is they're prone to get sarcosis and because of the way they feed, and, you know, they're down there. They're one of the first ones to migrate, and they're in that warmer water, and they'll pick that up, parasite up, and, you know, then they get rice breasts is what everybody calls it. But we've seen it in everything. So, you know, it's... I think if somebody sees something in print that somebody's writing a story and talking about how bad a spoon tastes or how bad a prime rib tastes, you know, they'll say, well, that's got to be a fact because it's in print. It's just like this fake news and everything else. But, I've fed many of people shovelers and snow geese over there, either in gumbo or off the grill. And you know, they're... None of it makes it inside the house if we're doing duck poppers on the grill before dinner. You know, you better go outside if you want some because they're gone.
Who is the, out of the three of y'all, who's the best cook?
Dad.
Big Al.
Dad.
Well, Big Al's not in the equation. He asked out of the three of us. Dad, hands down, he's a real good cook. He's definitely taught Stephen and I what we know about cooking wild game and grilling. That's for sure.
Well, I mean, it's a labor of love, whether it's sawmill gravy or gumbo or just whatever. But I mean, my mom taught me how to cook, and my grandmother, and Gail, my wife, she wanted to make sure the boys knew how to cook too, in case they married a girl that didn't know how. And a lot of that happens these days. You know, luckily they didn't, marry a girl that didn't know how to cook. Catherine and Felicia both cook and cook well. But I know Patrick does a lot of cooking at the house. And, you know, Stephen's the grill master, you know, at his house. And, you know, and it's passed down. But hopefully when you get up there, Big Al will be there. And, you know, Big Al's a towering 5'3", I guess, but that man had rather cook than hunt, and I don't mean it's beans and taters. I mean it's shrimp and grits, or crown rib roast, or tomahawk ribeyes, or just whatever. I mean, he will throw some stuff together, and you know you'll think you're eating in as good a restaurant you've ever been in. And that's what he likes to do. So we let him.
All right, so what is the Lane Gill's fatted calf? If somebody special's coming in, what is the, you know, just like in biblical days, you kill the fatted calf when the prodigal son's returning home because you're happy to see him. What is the fatted calf at Lane Gill?
Over the years, it has been field pot, for sure.
Yep. Matter of fact, I hate to hurt your feelings, boys, but that's what Mom and I had for supper tonight. I found
Thank
four
her.
Green wings, and I crock-potted them all day long with sausage and onions, and that's what we had for supper tonight.
I appreciate you waiting until I was there. That's great.
Well, I mean, we used to cook, and we've gotten off of it all because of one member, but he's just going to have to eat beanie weenies or something. But we're just going to get back to generally the opening day night, we'll have a big teal pot. And I mean, I'm talking 60, 70 of them, you know, cooked at a time. And you can reach in there and grab that little bitty leg bone and shake it, and it'll come out clean. You know, they're tender. A lot of people come there. They want to try the wild game too. And Specs done the same way. Are good, you know, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I know Al cooked them on the grill this year. We, you know, picked a speck, but then you know, flayed it off with like you know, left the fat on the grill. And man, he cooked those up, and those are some of the best I've ever had. As far as on the grills,
oh yeah.
I mean, it was had that raspberry, raspberry marmalade sauce, and it was just, oh my gosh.
It was hard to beat. But, you know, Al's the kind of cook that can throw 20 inch and a half thick ribeyes on the grill and bring them all off at the same time with them cooked anywhere from medium to medium rare. Anybody that orders one well done can go to, you know, get him a barbecue or something. That's like putting ketchup on it. He's pretty remarkable. He and his son are members, and we got a hell of a deal when Big Al decided he wanted to duck hunt with his son, because I don't think he was a gung-ho duck hunter, but, you know, now that his son's there, they bought a lab, and they're fixing to send it back to the trainer to get a handle put on it. And, you know, that's the kind of members we got, the ones that buy in to what we do. It may not be right, but it works, and everybody, you know, wants to be a part of it. And, you know, they're good friends. Of course, the idea of friendship is, you know, somebody that'll dog cuss you to your face but talk nice about you to your back. That's the kind of, you know, group of guys we got, you know. So it's taken us a while to get that. We've weeded through some, trust me. But I'm pretty happy right now.
It's a successful club. And you know, usually clubs are like churches. Sometime or another, they're going to divide up. But,
yeah.
Well, yeah, that happened too.
Oh, yeah.
It happened.
Some guys decided they were going to split off and start their own club. And the following season, we had people coming back saying, I want back in, which didn't happen. But every now and then we have to have a come to Jesus meeting. And it's generally when I go off on a tangent about something that may be trivial to them, but it pisses me off. So,
successful clubs have good rules. What are some examples of some good rules there at Lane Gill?
We don't have many.
We don't have many.
But they're probably pretty good, though.
Biggest rules we have, of course, is that's been made clear in several podcasts is no four wheelers and no robo ducks. Those are our two biggest rules.
We know those two, exactly. Now, we've touched on the hen. We've touched on the hen mallard.
Right.
There's a find that's been there forever.
Hen pintails.
Really hen mallard.
Yeah, hen mallard and hen pintails, because, you know, like it's been mentioned too, you know, we're not subsistence hunters. None of us have to go over there and hunt at that place to feed our families. It's all for enjoyment. Dead hens don't lay eggs. And, you know, with mallards being usually our number one duck, and pintails tend to be a fragile species as of late, dad's imposed a $10 fine. If you come in with a hen mallard or a hen pintail, it costs you $10.
And I don't care if you thought it was a gadwall or what, it's still going to cost you $10. But
that's what we buy our groceries throughout the year with, and stuff like that. I mean, it's our little kitty, you know, kitty fund to, like I say, go, you know, to run to Sam's and buy eggs and bacon and milk, or, you know, whatever. That's just how we flow along the year.
Yeah, we start the year off, everybody kicks in $100 to the food kitty, and then we pretty much subsist on that. And, you know, we had T-shirts made up that we make a little money off of when guests come in. They want to buy, you know, something to remember things with. But I think our main rule, other than the four-wheelers and the robo-ducks, is the way we do our pit rotations. It's not really a rule, but it's just the way we do things. And the way it works is, if you're in a pit today and five pits are being hunted, if you're low pit, you get first choice the next morning. So it's not like, you know, you hunted pit one today, tomorrow you got to hunt pit two. Well, it may suck too, and you're over there for 2 days and you're on the bottom end of the telephone pole or the totem pole. But this guarantees you that if you're there for 2 days minimum, you're going to have a chance at getting in the best pit there is. if you're stupid enough to pick a bad one, like some people have, and I shouldn't say stupid, but if you're not cognizant of the fact that the pit you need to pick, and we've had guys, you know, pick one that sucked when they had first choice, but that's the most fair and equitable way we can do it with everything. I know some clubs that you know which pitch you're going to be in from day one to the end of the season, and I never thought that was hardly fair because I hate to see somebody drive from South Carolina and know that they're going to be there 3 days and not be in a good pit. So,
that's kind of what I was getting at. What makes y'all successful, and you know the rules that you have that make you successful? There's a lot of people listening to that.
We have a grievance committee too.
Yeah, well, the grievance committee is a party of one, and it usually ends with, "I'm sorry, but I don't care, and this is how it's going to be."
Yeah, I'm kind of like Sheldon on Big Bang. You know, I got the final vote, and I've offered it. You know, I've told the boys, said, "Anytime y'all want to run this nut farm, you know, have at it." And they say, "No, Dad, you're doing a good job." So. Take it to the grievance committee.
No, me and Patrick are always going to put our 2 cents in, don't you know?
Oh, yeah. And sometimes I agree with them. Sometimes.
Who out of this group watches Big Bang Theory?
I do.
Do you really?
Well, yeah. Big Bang and Andy Griffith. Those are my two favorites.
Wow, that's two of my favorite shows, no joke. That's not the only thing that I watch on TV.
Well, we've got a good friend getting back to UT football. They've got season tickets ever since forever, and he's the only friend I got that doesn't duck hunt, and that'll let you know how special he is. But we call him Sheldon because he's a genius, really, and Michael and Mary Ann are dear friends of ours, but anyway, we got them watching Big Bang Theory.
You bring up that grievance committee. It kind of sounds like the roommate agreement. Hey, we got it lined out in black and white here.
That's right. And the bottom line is, I make the final decisions. You know, if somebody gets their panties in a wad, they can go, you know, sit out on the back porch till they realize that yeah, I'm right and they're wrong. I don't try to argue with anybody. I just tell them what they're doing wrong. Explain to them what you're doing wrong, and what you're doing wrong is arguing with me. So that works out pretty good.
You're talking about grievances. I bet as competitive as you three guys are, sometime or another you've been mad at each other. Do you remember a time in duck hunting? I'm not talking family. We'll keep the family issues off the air, if you do or don't have any. But do you remember a time ever being really, really mad at each other duck hunting?
Well, I think that goes back to the day I got the three bands, but they may not have been. Well, they probably were mad. I know they were at least upset. But, they may have a better one.
I don't know. You know, that's the thing, though. It's hard to be mad and stay mad about something that, in the grand scheme of things, doesn't amount to a hill of beans. I mean, you know, like you say, there's been a few little family issues because there's always going to be that somebody's going to be mad about something. But over there at the duck camp, I don't know. The mad doesn't seem to last real long.
No. And, you know, if I'm wrong, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, I'll probably tell you that I was. But the boys and I get along pretty well. I mean, you know, we'll get in some terse conversations at time, and generally it's you know, why didn't we shoot those ducks then, or you know, why didn't Steven call the shot on these specs, or Dad, your dog's barking or something like that. But I mean,
oh, that's a good one. Oh,
yeah.
Damn it, Dewey, when he was barking on the back porch. Oh, that was fantastic. Josh Criswell will love to hear this story because it was actually it was a work weekend, and first weekend Dad's new dog was at the camp, and Dad woke Josh out of a dead sleep. Hey, your dog's barking, and he goes out on the back porch. We got a 6-hole dog kennel built on the back porch, and Josh yanks the door open on his kennel to drag Toby out, and he's sound asleep. So Josh closes the door on the kennel, goes back and hides, and Dad's dog starts barking, and he gets to go inside and tell Dad's like, hey, that's your dog out there making all that noise.
Yeah. Well,
so Dewey is banned from the back porch. Dewey sleeps in the dog crate in the truck.
Yeah, he won't bark in the dog crate. And actually, I've had him in that kennel on the back porch with the door open where he could get out, and he'd sit there in the kennel and bark with it wide open in front of him. But anyway, that's where everybody came up with Damn It, Dewey, because that's what they'd hear me say when I'd have to go out there barefooted or with my house shoes to put him in my truck. But we have a lot of fun over there. I mean, you know, and it's all good fun. And it's getting to be, and it's better fun the last several years because I think we've gotten everybody on an even keel, and you know, people want to help and people want to work, and I find it real unusual that when something needs to be done, I'll have Bo or Kelly or somebody say, "You just sit there in your chair and we'll go take care of it." And I mean, used to if there was a water issue or a riser that had to be checked or something, you know, I'd have to go do it. But a lot of that isn't happening anymore, and it saves wear and tear. I mean, I do appreciate it.
Well, guys, I have enjoyed it. I'm glad we jumped off into the Lane Gill topic because that ended up being really good. I've really enjoyed listening to that.
Well, good.
Well, you can make or break any duck club, you know, just by overruling or you know, being tunnel vision or hard-headed or whatever, but I mean, you know, the bottom line is we're there to hunt and have a good time and eat good, and you know, if we kill some ducks, it's a bonus.
But we're going to kill some ducks.
Yeah, that's only time
that topic. That topic came up on Duck House a couple days ago. What's your most enjoyable thing about, or why do you duck hunt? And everybody's talking about the camaraderie and watching the morning come alive and all that. And I commented on there, and I mean it sincerely. I watch the sunrise at least 5 days a week. And I spend time with my friends and family all year long. I duck hunt to kill ducks. It makes it more fun when you're with good friends and when you're with your family and you're with a good dog. It definitely makes it more fun, but bottom line, you're there to kill stuff.
Yeah. I think the next podcast we do, I'd like to hit on some more memorable hunts that we've had, and you know, either with us or with friends and whatnot, and there's a lot to talk about. You know, we can just, the boys will mention something and it stirs a memory, like, oh yeah, I forgot about that. So, but
well, tonight was really good, and we'll jump back into some of those stories next week. Steven, Patrick, or yep. Pat, as I said, enjoy this. I look forward to it every Thursday night. It's a great time. Thank y'all again. We want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.